I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and this hour of the program, Jonathan Allen is with us. He is the author of the New York Times bestseller, and a fine read it is, Shattered: Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. He and his co-author spent about a year and a half putting this book together, and they thought, as most people in the country thought, that they were going to be writing, well, they did, people in the country didn't know that Jonathan was going to be writing this book, but he thought, and many others shared the same idea, that Hillary Clinton was going to win, and so they, Jonathan and his co-author, thought, we're going to be writing about, you know, how she won. Instead, it was a surprise to a lot of people, including the authors, that she lost, and the book looks very carefully and is the result of a year and a half and more than 100 interviews with Clinton's friends and foes and staff, and it's very, very thorough. So we're delighted to have Jonathan with us. Why did Hillary Clinton lose is the question of the hour. Jonathan is the head of community content at Sidewire, a political news analysis platform. He has reported for Bloomberg News, Politico, Congressional Quarterly, and he also was the author of, with Amy Parnes, of HRC, an account of her years as Secretary of State. Jonathan, hello. Thank you very much for joining us again to talk about the book. Now, I've read it, so we have a lot to talk about. Hi.
Hi. It's always my pleasure to be on with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. What a read this is. You know what's unbelievable still is that she had this huge rating. What was the favorability rating you cite early in the book of Secretary of State and this incredibly long resume? Everybody thought she had it in the bag, and oh my goodness, now I know why she didn't have it in the bag. I guess it had to do a lot with this vision thing, didn't it? She initially, you write in the books, wanted to kind of align herself with FDR. Can you tell us that story? And then how the vision thing kind of got lost?
Yeah, I mean, I think you kind of have to start with, as we do in the book, with her very first sort of major speech, mm-hmm. which she did on Roosevelt Island, which is in the East River in New York between Manhattan and Brooklyn. And she'd assigned this task to her top speechwriter on the campaign, a guy named Dan Schwerin. He went out and sought advice, as Clinton speechwriters often do, from a wide variety of people who have worked with them in the past. Tried to put it together. He was struggling with it. He couldn't get any of his drafts really past the communications director, Jen Palmieri, or the chief strategist, Joel Benenson. There were literally, you know, half a dozen to a dozen people working on this thing. And then, you know, on the other side, working at the same time, on a separate draft, were Lisa Muscatine, who was Hillary Clinton's speechwriter in the White House, and Jon Favreau, who was Barack Obama's chief speechwriter. And they came up with their own draft and submitted it. And none of these things were really thrilling anyone in the Clinton operation. And the thing that I think most of them struggled with is that she hadn't really set out what her mission was beyond winning the presidency. There wasn't an answer to the questions of, why her? Why now? Mm-hmm. She'd run in 2008 and still didn't have that sort of raison d'etre that was about other people rather than herself, or at least she wasn't able to communicate that clearly, you know, within the confines of this speech to begin with. And I think this was something that plagued her throughout the campaign. They finally, you know, and as she was getting ready to go to that first speech and heading toward that speech, she called Schwerin and added a line. A line that echoed Franklin Roosevelt's rendezvous with destiny line from one of his speeches. And, you know, it was interesting. She mentioned Franklin Roosevelt during her speech, and there were some echoes of him. But she also struggled with the question and sort of laid it out there of whether she was running for Barack Obama's third term or Bill Clinton's third mm-hmm. term. And I think there really was that sort of difficulty. In fact, one of her senior aides said to us, I would have had a reason for running, or I wouldn't have run.
Hmm. She evidently had looked at, and I thought it was a masterful stroke, when Obama went to Springfield, Illinois, and stood on the steps of the old Capitol and aligned himself with Abraham Lincoln. It brought tears to people's eyes, certainly. So she was studying that introduction, but really fell short with the way that she introduced herself, even though she had done her homework.
Absolutely, and she's somebody who has a real feel for history, and sometimes maybe too subtly evokes it. You know, she's standing there on Roosevelt Island, so that should be something that people connect with. But also, in the backdrop, you've got the United Nations building, and Eleanor Roosevelt was so instrumental in the formation of the UN and its early documents. And she, you know, so I think she wanted to kind of claim Franklin Roosevelt in the way that that Barack Obama had claimed Lincoln. And frankly, it's there's probably no one better for a Democrat to associate themselves with than Franklin Roosevelt in terms of, you know, the sort of domestic agenda that he had, that I think, you know, was really the sort of unifying piece for even modern day Democrats and certainly for generations after mm-hmm. him. And then, you know, a foreign policy piece that calls for American global leadership, and to not sacrifice the domestic side so that the United States can be involved overseas. You know, and she just didn't really hit that note, effectively.
Mm-hmm. The other big theme in the book, and she states this when she's already into the campaign, which is sort of hard for me to understand because it's her business to understand what's going on. But she said that she wasn't understanding the mood of the electorate. I don't understand what's happening with the country. I can't get my arms around it.
Yeah, she was on a flight with a good friend of hers and a longtime Democratic campaign operative named Mignon Moore. And Mignon had been brought in. She wasn't working on the campaign. She'd been brought in to sort of listen to what Secretary Clinton was saying and try to get a feel for where the candidate was. The candidate was kind of down in the dumps. She had just been really beaten badly in New Hampshire by, I think, 22 points. And she was trying to figure out why it was that she had, you know, only narrowly won in Iowa despite, you know, putting a ton of energy and resources into it. Why she'd been destroyed in New Hampshire, even though she had staged her big comeback there in 2008. And she just was having trouble getting it. And she could see that that the electorate was angry, but she was having trouble understanding the moment. And it's interesting, I think both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, for whatever faults they have, also, in contrast to Clinton, they both had a very good understanding of what the national sentiment was, where things were moving.
Right.
And so for Sanders, it was, you know, the system has been screwing you, so let's redistribute wealth and power from the top. And, for Trump, it was you're not getting enough because we're not focused enough on American jobs. And so for him, that was, to get rid of trade deals and to crack down on immigration and the whole rest of his policy. These were pretty easy to understand messages.
Yeah. What about Bill Clinton? He was an important advisor to her. He seemed to have a better handle of what was going on, didn't he?
I think he did. He was going out on campaign trips and talking to his friends around the country, people that had worked for him before. And his argument was that he and she were too often being sent to talk to the Democratic base, that the whole campaign strategy relied on finding out where they could get the most bang for the buck in terms of talking to people who already supported her to get them to turn out. And his view was that she needed to be out talking to people who disagreed with her or were on the fence and felt like the campaign wasn't doing enough of that. But coming off of 2008, where he shouldered a lot of the blame for her defeat, in part because of some impolitic things he said on the campaign trail about President Obama, but also in part because he had kind of strong-armed some of her aides back then into doing what he wanted, he took a reduced role this time in terms of guiding campaign strategy and largely did what he was told.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, I didn't know about this, which I wonder, and you've done a book on her too, which was well received probably by Hillary Clinton too, your earlier book, HRC. But this was an interesting piece of information to me, and I'm wondering what it says about her. After losing to President Obama, you write, in the 2008 primary, she was convinced she had lost because some staffers had been disloyal, and she instructed a trusted aide to access the campaign server and download the email messages sent and received by top staffers. I want you to tell us more about that, and did she have the same feeling in the 2016 campaign that some of her staffers were not very loyal, that she didn't like them very much? She thought they were out to get her, maybe.
Well, I think she had a better feeling about her staff in 2016 in terms of their intentions. She certainly didn't see a lot of leaks from her campaign. I think everybody on the campaign this time knew that she considered that to be disloyal and you know, sort of a fireable kind of offense because of 2008. And I think, you know, after 2008, she learned a lot of lessons. Some of them she overlearned. Sometimes I think she learned the wrong thing in the case of, you know, internal turmoil with the staff. I think that's usually more symptomatic than it is causal. It can be causal for campaign problems, but often it's a symptom that things are going wrong. You know, when you're winning and doing well, people tend to paper over their differences. In terms of downloading her staff's email at the end of the 2008 campaign, she had her IT staff go and pull some of those emails, and she got a very good, clear picture of what was going on in her campaign headquarters when she had been campaigning. And, you know, the benefit of that for her was she could see some of the breakdowns, and she could see, you know, who she thought was loyal and who was stabbing her in the back. And at the same time, you know, I think this sort of proves that she has a pretty good understanding of how powerful digital snooping can be. And,
right.
And of course, she did that before she set up the email server at the State Department. That would have prevented anybody, you know, from accessing her emails had courts not intervened and demanded that they be released.
Yeah. The private email server, it certainly was with her during the whole campaign and the election as well. It took her, I believe you say, 5 months before she apologized for that. Why didn't she just come right out at the beginning and say she was wrong about this and she never should have set up a system? Would it have stopped all of the questioning about the email server?
I don't think it would have stopped all of the questioning about it, but certainly I think, you know, in retrospect, and even at the time, there were those who told her that she wasn't going to politically be able to get past it or get people to focus on anything else unless she apologized for it. She and her husband believed she hadn't done anything wrong. And, of course, the legal implications of apologizing for something that you're saying on a legal basis, you know, you didn't break the law, are, you know, the optics of that are bad. And, you know, you could potentially hurt, as we're seeing with the president now, you could potentially hurt your legal case with things that you say for political benefit. So, you know, I think there were some constraints on her, and at the same time, there was probably a way for her to acknowledge that she had, you know, she had done something that seemed dishonest or seemed like it seemed like she was hiding something.
Mm-hmm. Did it ever not seem to you as though she was hiding something?
No, I mean, I think she was clearly hiding something. I think she set up the email server so that other people wouldn't be able to access her email. I think that was the big... Look, this is somebody for 25 years who has watched every spoken word and every memo she's ever sent come out into the public, some of it through, you know, more nefarious means, some of it simply through archives, presidential library, or Freedom of Information Act requests from reporters. But she is acutely aware of how much trouble can be caused by her private thoughts becoming public. And so I think, you know, the only explanation that really adds up is that she didn't want people seeing her email.
Mm. A lot of people would say that she didn't have, you say in the book, which I think is an interesting way and an accurate way to put her, the way she campaigned, her belief that policy is vision. She really knew policy. You couldn't say about Hillary Clinton that she hadn't done her homework or she didn't know what the issues were, but that it came off, many people said, she didn't see her human side. We didn't see her humorous side. People said she was a lot of fun, and we didn't see that very often at all. We saw a lot of policy, but not a lot of humanity from her. What happened there? Did she show that at any point? Did people say, you know, you need to be more of a human being, or was she so much a part of the Washington world and State Department and giving speeches to Wall Street that she didn't see just being a human being?
I think one of the things that is a sort of an eternal struggle for her is that she is someone who is naturally a very private person who keeps seeking public office.
Hmm.
And I think that she is very loath to show vulnerability, to show weaknesses. I think part of that has to do with, you know, the generation she's from and her gender. You know, I think that she came of age at a time when women really had to show that they were tough enough to to move forward in politics and business and law.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that's partially her sort of natural inclination. And as a result, you know, I think our humanity shows most often when we, you know, show our weaknesses and sometimes our strengths, but the sort of deviation from being a robot, you know, whatever your imperfections or differences are with other people, you know, you kind of show those things, and they add up to your humanity. And so I think that's always been one of the reasons people see her as somewhat robotic or mechanical, because she doesn't like to show those things. And I think one of the strengths of this book is that we get behind the scenes and see some of the doubts that she had. We see some of the weaknesses
right.
she had. We see some of the private moments where she's kind of, you know, like the one you mentioned before, where she's confessing she's not really sure what's going on with the electorate. And I think those are moments where her humanity really comes out.
Yeah. We have a ton of phone calls. I just want to jump around. So we'll go to the end before we go to the middle and go back to the beginning, to the chorus, during the course of the rest of the hour. She was, all these circumstances happened at the same time. And I wonder what you think about Comey's decision about dressing her down, saying he wasn't going to prosecute. There wasn't anything there, but how careless she was. Followed by, which was interesting, I forgot, the very next day, Obama is going to a rally with her in North Carolina, I believe, and it's kind of overlooked press coverage because of what Comey had done the day before.
It's actually the same day.
Oh, it was the same day. Oh,
he came out
my.
That morning, and she traveled to Charlotte, North Carolina with Obama on that very same day. So the bang she got for getting that first joint appearance with Obama was lessened and stifled by this Comey news. And, you know, look, it is somewhat reasonable and happens pretty often that a police officer will give someone a lecture rather than a ticket. That is not something that is common or usual or appropriate for the FBI director to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've never seen a case where the FBI director read essentially an indictment against somebody that the agency did not recommend a prosecution of. So that was a really strange move. I think he felt like this was his opportunity to step into the spotlight. You know, Loretta Lynch and Bill Clinton had recently met on a tarmac, and Lynch all but recused herself from the case. He stepped into the spotlight, felt he had to explain why he wasn't going after a prosecution, given how much attention there had been to it. And I think, you know, that was something that very few other people, if any, would have done.
Mm-hmm. And he thought, was he saying what he really believed when, I think he was talking to John Podesta about the state of the race? He was saying to Hillary Clinton and to John as well, you know, don't worry about this. You've got this. You've got this. You've got this race.
President Obama, yeah, I think he believed she was going to win. He was looking at the same numbers she was looking at,
right.
that we were all looking at. You know, I mean, I don't think he had any... I think he was very surprised when she lost.
Mm. And then she called him the night of the election and said very softly, I'm sorry.
Yeah, there's, you know, we go through this in the book sort of in minute-by-minute detail, how she finds out that she's, you know, losing and then going to lose, and the sort of resistance to that within her own camp, and the debate about whether or not to concede. The White House started putting pressure on her, first through her campaign manager, Robbie Mook, then finally the president called her and urged her to concede, and he called John Podesta just to make sure that the message had gotten across. She decided that she was going to do that, called Trump, congratulated him, and then as she's sitting down to look at her concession speech for the first time, and by the way, that's, you know, a sort of an exhibit A of the confidence that she had. She'd gone over the victory speech earlier in the evening, but not the concession speech. She's going to sit down to work on the concession speech, and Huma Abedin, her closest personal aide, approaches with a phone and says it's the president, and Clinton winces visibly. I mean, she does not want to take this call. She
right.
realizes it's the president of the United States calling, you know, placing a consolation call essentially, and she takes the phone, and she, you know, she realizes she's let herself down, and she's let her party down and the country down as far as she's concerned with Donald Trump being elected. And of course, she thinks she's let Barack Obama down because his legacy is now vulnerable to to Trump, and she, as you say, she puts the phone to her ear and says, "Mr. President, I'm sorry." Mm.
Let's welcome phone calls. We have many of them coming in for you. Jonathan Allen is our guest this hour, co-author of Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. Our phone number, don't try right now, try in a couple minutes when the lines are open, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is, please leave your messages there because, you know, it's fun to read what you have to say about this after the show. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to your many phone calls, starting with Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Thanks. To the author, you could have titled your book Shattered by the Deplorables, because even though you're you seem to be a very kind man and very gentle with Hillary Clinton, saying she's essentially a private person not wanting to make public her private thoughts. In the midst of the campaign, to label people which you might want, some of whom you might want, to come over to your side to vote for you as the deplorables, I thought was completely tone deaf to politics. I mean, I had predicted that Donald Trump was highly electable. I got in trouble with friends and family by saying that, and I urged people to vote for Hillary Clinton, which I did. I think he's turning out to be an awful president, but I think we had a candidate who, in terms of how she announced to the world what she thought, how she thought she and her ilk were like the elite of the political class. I thought that was just stupid. I'm sorry, but I do. I think that was just tone deaf, stupid on her part.
Thanks for your call, Rich. Jonathan.
Yeah, I agree completely. And we talk about that in the book. You know, one of the things that Amy and I focused in on was not just the deplorable comment, but that right after that, she referred to the people she was calling deplorable as irredeemable. And for a woman who was running on a slogan of stronger together, that seemed like an odd thought. Also for somebody who speaks pretty frequently about her Christianity, the idea of someone being irredeemable is sort of outside the domain of religious thought. And so, you know, I think there was a lot she said in that one night that was pretty damaging to her. Certainly those who were opposed to her to begin with didn't like it, and I think a lot of people who were open-minded or still hadn't closed the door on her closed it right then.
Hmm. Thank you, Rich, very much for your call. Laura in Twin Lakes, hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever the subject would come up of releasing his financials, his tax returns, I would cringe because he was never put on the spot. I believe five words might have won the election. And Mr. Trump, what are you afraid of? If she drilled it home and not let him change the subject or deflect, which he definitely would do, as that's his defense, is to attack, I believe that he's afraid to release his financials, and she just didn't challenge him to be truthful and open. I, you know, ask him, are you afraid of what the American people will think when they know about your bankruptcies, about your, you know, get a little specific. And I believe that she would have had it hands down.
Jonathan.
I'm not sure whether that wins the election for her or not. Sort of almost any factor could change it with so few votes in the important states, or the states that turned out to be important that I think some of us didn't expect, for instance, Wisconsin.
Right.
Certainly she failed to portray him as weak. And that might have, I think, you know, one of the things that seems to get under his skin the most is when people portray him as anything other than strong. And that might have been an effective angle to take.
And speaking of Wisconsin, I think that's what Brian wants to do. Brian, hi.
Hi, how are you, Kathleen?
Good, how are you?
Good.
Good.
You know, I don't understand why she never took her time to come to Wisconsin or Michigan or, you know, Indiana or whatever the milk and honey states that they needed to get to win. And then she did nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, oh, fine. Oh, that's fine. We'll just let it go and we'll see if we win. But then Trump came in and then he took us all over because we were fed up with all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm not a right winger. I'm an independent.
Mm-hmm.
And I like both sides.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, it's what's so funny is, like the lady just said before, you know, the financial records of the, you know, Clinton Foundation and stuff like that. Where are their records? If you're going to go for Trump and ask for his tax records, then where are the records for the Clinton Foundation?
Mm-hmm. Let's first go to Wisconsin. She was scheduled to go to Green Bay with President Obama, but then the shooting took place in Orlando, so they couldn't come. But why didn't they reschedule that? Why didn't they come to Wisconsin? It doesn't make any sense.
I agree with you, Kathleen. The thinking inside the campaign was that there were some states where, at least they'd seen in the primary, this is what they concluded after Michigan in the primary where she lost at the end. They came to believe that there were places where if they sent Hillary Clinton, more people would become aware of the election who were unlikely to vote without being as aware of it and would come out and vote against her.
Uh-huh.
That it would be counterproductive for her to show up in some of these places. So I think that was the calculation, part of the calculation in Wisconsin. It was part of the calculation in Michigan. She did go to Grand Rapids, Michigan, I think, at the very, very end of the campaign. And also, in addition to that, they believed that they were up. So they thought they were nursing a small but significant lead and didn't want to change anything. Now, people on the ground in Wisconsin who were Democrats were screaming and yelling for the campaign to get in there,
mm-hmm.
not just with the candidate, but with, you know, with literature, with attempts at persuasion. One of the other calculations that the campaign made, and this is a big sort of divide within the campaign, was that the people who worked on data and used data to make determinations about where to send candidates and surrogates and, you know, how to spend the money inside states, basically decided that it was not useful to try to persuade people to vote for her, that it was much more efficient to try to find people who agreed with her and get them to come out. And so they really abandoned persuasion efforts in the traditional sense, which is what most people try to do in politics, is to persuade voters, and certainly what Bill Clinton was calling for, saying that, you know, that the campaign ought to do more to get out and talk to folks that disagreed with them.
Well, I remember when Donald Trump came to Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and I was thinking, what in the world is he doing in that part of the state? It's a Democratic part of the state. And then I realized, partially from him reading your book, too, that they were seeing other kinds of numbers that even they couldn't believe, the Republicans, that he could indeed win this. They must have known what was going on in Wisconsin.
You know, it's interesting. And we report this in the book, I think Republicans saw some things that encouraged them, and at the same time, they didn't always believe what they were seeing.
Right, I know.
They found that it was surprising. There was some polling that the Republican Party had that they chose not to. They shared some of the information with reporters, but didn't share it for some of the states because they thought that they would be made fun of because the numbers looked so rosy in places that they weren't expected to win. And so, you know, it's. Trump was a real shock for not just Democrats, but also for a lot of Republicans.
Yeah. Thank you, Brian, very much for your call. Larry from Stevens Point sends this email. I voted for Hillary, but was turned off by the contention that it was her turn. The RNC ran a lousy primary leading to Trump's election. Looking back, more of us should have voted for Bernie. Jonathan?
It's impossible to know what would have happened with different candidates unless you run the race, because you don't know how they would have attacked each other, what would have been effective, which states would have been in play. I mean, there are so many variables there that it's hard to know. But, you know, I think it's a good lesson, just generally speaking, that people want to vote for the candidates they like the best.
Yeah. What about his contention that it was her contention that it was her turn? Was that a part of the campaign?
Well, it certainly wasn't something that she was pushing. It wasn't something that they were trying to define as her turn. I think that, and in talking to her campaign aides, that they came to an understanding that when they were not pushing a positive narrative about her, and they spent a lot of the campaign not pushing a positive narrative about her, that people would fill in their own reasons for why she was running, and one of them was the idea that it was her turn.
Mm-hmm.
They kept having all these, who came up with all these varying, and I'm wondering even how important they are, breaking barriers, I'm with her, all of these different kinds of slogans. And I know Bernie thought that he was asked to do an ad, and he thought it was phony, and he didn't want to say what the slogan was. Who came up with all of those, and does it make a difference? Do people really, I guess I'm with her kind of caught on, but I couldn't even remember some of the other slogans.
Well, it was a series of committees, and I think some of the problems with the slogans tie into that lack of a fundamental message about the electorate. I mean, I'm with her is about her.
Right.
It's not she's with me or she's with us.
Yes, right.
For us.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, we talk about that some in the book. The episode you mentioned with Senator Sanders, you know, she knew she was having trouble with some of the millennials that might otherwise have voted for her. And her campaign asked Bernie Sanders to cut an ad for her. He had promised to do whatever he could to help elect her, so he decided that he would do it. He sits down with a consultant, one of his consultants, to film the ad. He's like kind of working through the script. Everything seems pretty good to him. And then he gets to the end and it says, I'm with her. And he says, I'm not saying that. It's so phony.
Mm-hmm.
And then her campaign took the ad and showed it to focus groups, and they didn't like what they saw for focus groups who didn't necessarily believe that Bernie was all in for her, or that, you know, sometimes they thought that he was articulating his message and not hers, and they decided not to ever run it on broadcast, which I think, you know, some folks who were familiar with that ad think was a mistake.
Mm. The other ad that you mentioned, was it Nevada where she embraced the young dreamer? It sounded like a very moving movement. I never saw the ad, but it sure was effective.
Yeah, she went to essentially a private event with some dreamers, and this young girl was talking about how she was afraid that her parents might be deported, and you know, Clinton put her arms around the little girl and said, you know, something to the effect of, you know, you worry about what you need to get done. I'll worry about keeping your parents in the country. And it was a touching moment. Her campaign had, you know, sort of videotaped the event, as they videotape pretty much everything she does. And they quickly made it into an ad. And I think it was, you know, one of the more powerful, positive messages for Clinton over the course of the campaign. But, you know, the strategy in the general election for her was to disqualify Donald Trump. And to some extent, she was successful. About a fifth of his voters said they didn't think he was fit to be president and still voted for him, which, you know, raises the question of whether she might have done more to make the sale for herself.
Yeah. Let's go to Nancy in Milwaukee. Hi, Nancy.
Well, this is Ed in West Dallas.
Oh, okay. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Hillary Clinton lost this election for one and only one reason. She couldn't talk the vocabulary and lingo of organized labor. She couldn't say labor vincit omnia. She needed to get 777,788 votes to flip this thing. And we told her and the people in Brooklyn constantly to come back here, to campaign, to be in Michigan, to be in Ohio, and it was all ignored. And ignored because she has no rhetorical ability to talk to laboring and unionized workers.
Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a huge problem for her. We talk about this in the book. You know, we use Michigan, the primary, as an example. She understood that Bernie Sanders was beating her on the economy. She went in with an economic pitch. What she didn't understand is that the people she needed to come out for her cared about one thing and one thing only, and that's trade. When she did talk about trade, she said she was against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was already kind of a problem for her because she had helped shepherd it into existence as Secretary of State. And rather than saying just that she was against the TPP or why she was against the TPP, she actually said she was against it and then set the conditions under which she could approve of similar trade deals. You know, it sounded, I think, two-faced, and I think a lot of the voters, who cared about that issue just wanted somebody to just say, no, I'm pulling the plug on this thing. And that's what Bernie Sanders was saying, and it's what Donald Trump was saying. I think the caller's absolutely right that she did a terrible job courting organized labor.
And we go to Nancy in Milwaukee. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I felt that when Hillary Clinton made the decision to become a senator, and chose to be a senator from New York, that really showed her true spirit. Because if she had really been thinking of middle-class Americans, she surely would have wanted to represent as a senator the people from Arkansas, where she had lived for so long, or from Illinois, where she originally came. And for her to instead want to be the senator from New York, to me, spelled that she simply wanted the power and the prestige. And I've cut out many articles that have appeared in many publications all during the time of the campaign. All of them talked about money pouring into her foundation. She only met with people who were willing to give money to the foundation. And the exorbitant amounts of money that she won for giving speeches, I have come to despise both those Clintons, and I referred to them as sleazy and slimy. And she's even talking now about running again for the presidency. I can hardly believe this woman and this grasp with her constant supercilious expression on her face, her constant grasp for this presidency. But Bill Clinton, when he was president, was asked about her presidency, and he blithely said, well, 8 years for Bill, 8 years for Hill.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason she ran in New York is because she was most certain she could win there as compared to Arkansas and Illinois. She has also said that she's not running for president, though there are people who are, a lot of analysts think that she is, that she may change her mind on that. She actually said, as we detail in the book, on election night, she was talking to her aides and said, that was my last race. And she has since publicly said she won't run for president again. But Barack Obama also said he wasn't running for president and ended up running for president. So nothing would shock me. I doubt she's going to try that again. I don't think it will be successful if she does.
Would the Democrats want her to be their standard bearer again?
It depends on the Democrat you talk to. There are certainly Democrats who would like to see her run again. She likes to cite the 66 million people who voted for her. Certainly some number well short of that wants her to run again, and there are a lot of Democrats who would like to see her either exit the stage or pick her battles.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Nancy, very much for your call. Let's go to Craig in Mount Alaska. Hi, Craig.
Hi. My question is to the guest. Since Hillary won the popular vote, how do you think that's affected her since the election?
Yeah, I think it's reinforced in her mind the idea that she wasn't defeated or wasn't defeated honestly. You hear her, she has said that she takes responsibility for her loss, but then quickly pivots to blaming all of the other possible factors, the Russians, Jim Comey, the Democratic National Committee, and the Electoral College system. She lost the primary in 2008 in part because Barack Obama had a much better understanding of how to accumulate delegates. She thought if she won big states, she would end up winning the nomination, and she was wrong on that. In this case, she won the popular vote but was not as careful or crafty with the Electoral College as Trump was. He focused intently on the Rust Belt states, and he told one Democratic official, as we report in the book, that he did it because he could see the hostility out there.
Hmm. Isn't it ironic when you just said that? Here you have Hillary Clinton. Her husband was president for 8 years. She's been inside politics for a long, long time. And who gets what you just described? Donald Trump, who's never held public office in his whole life.
Right. I mean, sometimes when you're inside, it's hard to see, exactly where you stand and where you're trying to go. And I think for Trump, it was a pretty simple calculation. You need to get 270 electoral votes. What's the path to do that?
Right.
But that said, I mean, he had to kind of shoot the moon to win, and he did.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did. Craig, thanks for the call. Dick in Middleton. Hi.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. A lot of things have been mentioned here. I think one thing was the Supreme Court opening. That was kind of a difference in position between Hillary and Trump. But the one thing that I don't hear mentioned much the Dems lost a lot of seats during Obama's administration time.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of this was a referendum on President Obama. I really do.
Jonathan?
I think some of it was. Certainly there was a lot of frustration among independents with Obamacare and especially with those letters going out about premium increases in October. It's not something you hear Democrats talk about because they would prefer for that to not be part of the story. They don't want people thinking that they lost because of Obamacare. They're trying to protect Obamacare. There was that moment, I think it was in Wisconsin, correct me if I'm wrong, Kathleen, but where Bill Clinton went out on the trail and said, Obamacare is the craziest thing, and his hands got smacked by the campaign, and he sort of pulled back and kind of walked it back. But I think it was actually, I think what he was saying was actually in tune with what a lot of voters were feeling. And it wasn't that he was saying you should scrap Obamacare, but I think he was trying to, trying to gain the trust of voters by talking about it the way that they talked about mm-hmm. it. You know, it's the craziest thing that that you're getting fewer choices and it's costing more. Like that's, and even for people who didn't see their premiums rise, they could see what's going on with the rest of the, with everybody else and how that might affect them over time and see their premiums rise. And it just, Obamacare was, I think, a lot harder of an issue for the Democrats to deal with than they wanted to admit.
Mm. As long as we're talking about Bill Clinton, you cover this in the book, but you have to wonder what this guy is thinking. You'd think he'd be much more politically savvy than this. The meeting with Loretta Lynch, when he goes into her plane because he discovers they're on the same runway, which subsequently caused a whole big problem if she needed more for Hillary Clinton. Does he not think about what he's doing at times, or why in the world would he do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the response from the White House and the Clinton campaign. Like, what the heck was he thinking?
Right.
If you compare it to Donald Trump's behavior, though, in office, Trump, asked the FBI director directly whether he was under investigation, asked the FBI director to back off of an investigation into one of his aides, and then fired the FBI director and said it was because of the investigation. All of those things are much more, powerful in terms of potential abuse of power than meeting on a tarmac. And at the same time, I think Bill Clinton is savvy enough to know that meeting with Loretta Lynch at that time, even if he didn't bring up the case, was a message sent.
We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Jonathan Allen is our guest. We had him on for All Things Political a couple weeks ago, and I said, oh, you have to be back after I read your book. He said, okay, so here he is today. The book is Shattered Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. Our number is 800. Thanks, Dick, for your call, 800-486-8655. Facebook, leave your comments there. If you can't get on the air, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. 800-486-8655 is our number, and we go next to Elaine in Colfax. Hello, Elaine.
Hi. My comment is that Trump knocked down 15 experienced politicians using infantile insults, and just every day was a shock of what he'd say. He'd get on the news. It was reported like stenographers, everybody said what he said.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't analyze it, not very much. They didn't analyze the people around him or describe, for instance, Steve Bannon's background at length. If that was a Democrat, my God, that would have been huge news, a right-wing extremist in the White House advising the potential president. And also, I get so tired of this this idea that... when she referred to the basket of deplorables, she did say what those were, sexism, racism, misogyny. She was referring to Trump's own speech, which was, like on a daily basis, you could have 1,000 worse comments made by Trump than this one particular mistake by Hillary Clinton. There's no way she should have won. I mean, I'm sorry. There's no way she would have lost despite her... mistakes in her campaign and some of her personal failings as a candidate. There's no way. It's the responsibility of the United States people that this happened.
And what does that say about the people? What are you saying about the people?
Well, I'm saying that the ignorance, the ability to tolerate this meanness, a man who was a pathological liar and obviously completely ill-equipped to handle the job. It's really an abomination, and it's on us, the people.
Jonathan, is it on us? Is it on her?
Well, it is. I mean, it is the responsibility of the American public to pick the president, and so you know, we to that extent in our democratic republic, we essentially get what we ask for, and we are watching the Trump presidency now, and I think you know some people are thrilled with it, and others are not. His approval ratings are pretty low, well below 50%, and a lot of polls, well, you know, somewhat below 40%. You know, the question is there are two questions. Number one, what does that mean for him going forward? And that's probably the most important one and for the country going forward. And then secondly, you know, does anybody have buyer's remorse? And I think the answer to that is not many. I mean, you don't see a lot of polls that show that people who voted for him would have voted differently now that they've mm-hmm. seen him in action.
Yeah. Elaine, thanks for your call. Stephen Morris. Hi, Steve.
Hey, good afternoon. I'd like to ask the author, at what point in the fall did he make the prediction that Trump was going to win? When did you go on the record calling that out? And if you didn't, why not? You're analyzing it now after the fact, but I'm just wondering about the credibility of when did you say, hey, everybody, Trump's got this in the bag?
So I didn't. I would just submit, I think the reason that this book works to the extent that it does, or one of the big reasons is that my co-author and I carefully reported what was going on behind the scenes without an eye toward who the eventual winner would be. We both expected she was going to win, but we also were carefully reporting the things that were not going right for her campaign. In fact, our editor called us in October and said, you guys have a problem. And we said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, look, you've got all these, you know, sort of all these foreboding things about her campaign, and she's going to be the next president of the United States. And you're going to have to figure out how to reconcile that.
Huh.
And we just sort of held our breath and said, look, why don't we figure that out when we know who's actually been elected? And it was something we were concerned about, you know, before the election a little bit. But we didn't really have to go back and tear things up because we had been, you know, sort of writing the ups and downs of this. And I, you know, people have told us that when they read it, they really go feel like they're inside. They're watching the ups and downs as they happen. And the one other thing that I would say is I did write for an op-ed for the New York Daily News in December of 2015 that said that Trump was going to win the Republican nomination if the Republican Party didn't figure out how to stop him.
Hmm.
And that was a pretty early prediction of that. There were others who had predicted it earlier, but Trump actually sent that out to his sent it out as an email to his supporters. So you know, he obviously thought that was a sort of major moment of prediction.
Interesting. One more call very quick. We only have 45 seconds. I'm sorry. Tony, go to it.
I always felt that it was Monica Lewinsky and the disgrace of Bill Clinton that cost Al Gore the election because he had to separate himself from Bill Clinton. 12 years later, is that what did Hillary Clinton in from losing the 88,000 votes that would have put her over the top?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know exactly how many votes are affected by that one way or the other. I would say that I'm a little surprised that she, when Donald Trump attacked her and tried to use Bill Clinton as a shield for his own behavior, that she didn't distance herself from both of their behavior.
Mm, yeah.
But there was an opportunity for her to say, you're right, my husband's done some things wrong and I don't approve of them. That doesn't mean that I reject my husband. Doesn't mean I don't love him. It just means he's done some things he shouldn't have and you've done some things you shouldn't have and you're on the ballot this time. I was surprised we didn't hear anything of that.
Thanks, Tony, for the call. Jonathan, it's a great read. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Kathleen. Take care.
Shattered is the book, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes are the authors of the piece. Thanks very much to Colleen Leahy for producing this hour and to Colleen as well for on-air production here in our studios. Thanks for listening. We'll be with you again mañana at 1 o'clock. So until then.